The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You're listening to the Kunstler Cast, a weekly conversation about the tragic comedy of suburban sprawl, featuring James Howard Kunstler, author of The Geography of Nowhere, The Long Emergency, and World Made by Hand. I'm Duncan Crary. Today's topic, wishful thinking.
How's it going, Jim?
Oh, well, it's nice to be here.
Yeah, in your house, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad I allowed myself to be here in my own house.
Okay, we have a listener call that's going to set the stage for the show today, so let me play that for you.
Hi, this is Sasha from Winchester, Virginia. Longtime listener, actually, since podcast number one, and fan of Jim's writing. I've read all his books. Anyway, I got to alert you to this article in the religion section of today's Washington Post, Saturday, May 31st. It's entitled, Activists Keep the Faith, If Not Their Money. Apparently, there are religious activists praying at D.C. gas stations, hoping for divine intervention for the price of gas to go down. And I was just floored by this and think you should check out this article. I mean, clearly, this is a direct example of the Jiminy Cricket type syndrome that Jim writes about, people wishing for energy to go down. It's just unbelievable. Anyway, check it out, and keep up the good work. Thanks.
Well, Sasha, thanks for calling that to our attention. I did check out the article. Jim, this sounds like a classic Jiminy Cricket cargo cult type scenario, right?
Yeah, and let me be clear about this. I'm not against prayer, but generally I think you should apply it in asking God to give you cool things, you know, like presents and, you know, electronic equipment and lottery ticket winnings.
But cheaper, lower gas prices is a cool thing, isn't it? I mean,
well, it's a little kind of pedestrian, you know, and no pun intended.
Okay, one of my favorite parts of The Long Emergency is when you bust out with cargo cults. I mean, I remember studying these things in anthropology class in college.
Yeah, Marvin Harris wrote these wonderful books about them, you know.
So tell our listeners, just in case they haven't read this section in your book, tell our listeners, what is a cargo cult?
Well, it starts the story really comes out of the South Pacific with the Second World War experience. And what happens is you have these very primitive cultures in the South Pacific and Indonesia, et cetera, on these islands, places that really haven't seen a whole lot of modern stuff before. And there's this huge avalanche of modernity that overwhelms them during World War II, where, you know, all of a sudden, first the Japanese come, build air bases, and, you know, dig into the islands and dig into all these little corners of the South Pacific. And then the Americans come and sweep them away. And in the meantime, all this modern stuff gets distributed to the peoples. Radios and cookware and wonderful tools and axes and machetes and things you can really do something with out there in the jungle.
Probably cigarettes and bubble gum,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, all kinds of stuff, you know.
Nose hair trimmers.
Oh, yeah. Those were real big in the South Pacific, especially if you can get the boar's tusk out of your nose, you know, to do that. No, but anyway, so then World War II concludes, and all of this modern stuff recedes into history, and they don't get it anymore, and the planes are not landing full of stuff anymore, and all the action is over, and it's back to primitive life again. And what happens is in some of these cultures, this becomes a sort of religious fetish. And they think, oh, well, how do we get these airplanes back with all this stuff, all this cargo? And they think, well, maybe we'll build a kind of an airplane and put it on this mountaintop and it will attract an airplane. Like, it'll be like a, you know, a decoy duck, you know, but for an airplane.
Made out of wicker or something, right?
So that's what they would do. They would, you know, whatever their local material was, bamboo or whatever, they would construct something that looked like an airplane and put it on a mountaintop in the hopes of luring some stray airplane down full of, you know, cooking pots and machetes. And it was called a cargo cult.
Well, they still actually exist today. National Geographic, I think, just had cargo cults mentioned a few issues ago. Still today. They're recreating everything. They have guys dressed up like the military marching bands. They do a whole ceremony for this.
Now, do they do this for tourists? Or
I thought it was legit, but I don't know.
Well, maybe. But I do think that culture has tremendous persistence, including neurotic cultures. And this is clearly a neurotic response to a really peculiar circumstance. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we're seeing a parallel of this in American life today, where we've had this, 70-year bonanza of stuff and cheap fuel and gasoline and happy motoring. And now that it's starting to look like it will recede, you're getting a lot of neurotic kind of wishful behavior around that, like people praying for lower gas prices or praying for some kind of new mystery miracle fuel to run all of our cars on and keep on running Walt Disney World and Walmart. And I think the more severe this withdrawal from all these goodies becomes, the more delusional and wishful and crazy and neurotic our behavior is going to get in the face of it.
Yeah.
You know, one of the manifestations of this is legalized gambling in America and the fact that it has become so normal. When I was a young person, gambling occupied the margins of American life. And I think rightfully so. And I'm not saying, you know, there should be no gambling, because there will be gambling no matter what you do, even if people set it up in the backs of bars or in basements. You know, like in that Broadway play Guys and Dolls, where they're having a crap game in the sewer, you know, because there's no other place to have it. So gambling will naturally gravitate, I think, in a healthy society to the margins, and you just sort of have to tolerate it there and not waste too much public resource chasing it around with vice squads and stuff. But we've put it right in the heart and mainstream of American life, and Las Vegas has turned into kind of a secondary Walt Disney World, you know, a place that it's okay to take your family on vacation. And this is a very destructive, dangerous, and crazy thing. Because at the bottom of the whole Las Vegas phenomenon is the belief that it's possible to get something for nothing, which is an idea that's not consistent with reality, you know? And it's very dangerous for a culture to accept this idea on a broad basis, because then everybody is expecting to get things for nothing and not having to work for stuff and not having to be earnest about making things happen. And it's led us to become a dangerously wishful people.
Well, let me ask you something. The article was about religious groups praying for gas, and I do think that that's absurd. I don't want to mock all religions, but I think that going around praying for lower gas prices is worthy of being mocked. And I this is not my idea, but a listener did contact me about mega churches in suburbia, and how, because we've created such a vacuous living arrangement in suburbia, these mega churches can swoop in and fill some kind of a void. But the religion that these mega churches are preaching is very, it's very simplistic. And it's kind of a Jiminy Cricket type religion that they're preaching, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, it's kind of tragic and sad. The vacuum of suburban life has provoked this sort of crisis of community in which people don't feel like they're part of anything meaningful, larger than their own household. And sometimes the households themselves are so broken up and atomized that they're not even a part of that. And it's sad, you know, and it's really taking a huge toll on the American people. The trouble is that, you know, the model of the mega church is the same as the consumerist model mall.
It's like a mall, yeah.
It's a direct equivalent, and you know, for the spiritual supply side, it is the mall.
You know, I've never been to one. Have you?
Inside a mega church?
Yeah.
Actually, no. Yeah. I mean, I've seen him on TV. That's, you know.
I have a friend who sold his soul on eBay and ended up writing a book going around reviewing.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah, that's a friend of mine, Hemant Mehta. And anyway, he has been into a lot of these mega churches.
It's a wonderful idea. I am familiar with the marginal religious scene because, as I may have mentioned before, when I was a young newspaper reporter, I did specialize in investigating religious cults. And I've been in and amongst that kind of activity, but I haven't been in one of those new, you know, arena-like churches, although I've seen them on TV. And I have watched them out of morbid curiosity just to get an idea of what's going on there.
Well, I think that there's some... I think that the author of the book Bowling Alone...
Oh, yeah, Robert Putnam.
...addresses that topic. I haven't read that book, though. I think he addresses that topic.
Well, you know, the whole dynamic of a living arrangement where you really don't have a meaningful relationship with other people. You're not working side by side with your neighbors at anything meaningful. You don't have business relationships with local people because, you know, the business is all done by Walmart. You know, all this has had a tremendously corrosive effect on American life, and it's made people desperate.
But here's my question. You touch upon this in The Long Emergency, the importance of maybe religious conviction to solve the problems that we're entering in the future. Or you sort of phrase it as a question. What is powerful enough to motivate people to solve these problems?
Well, I'm not even sure that I put it that way, but what I do think is that a lot of the organizing principles and armatures and structures that people hang their lives on now are going to be vanishing and disintegrating. You know, everything from your job in a corporation to school life. You know, I've noticed in the last few days that there are school districts now out there that are ramping down to 4 days a week because the cost of running suburban school districts is just so enormous they can't keep them going 5 days a week. You know, all these structures of everyday life that help us organize our lives are falling away. And I have a feeling that there isn't going to be a whole lot of structure left except what may be supplied by some kind of a spiritual or church setting.
Here's the problem that I see, though. Most of the religions, I think that as organizations, they would be equipped to help us into the new future. But I don't think the message that a lot of them are preaching is actually one of humanism, let's say, about fixing the human
habitat. No, I think what's probably most characteristic about, evangelical Protestantism in our time, especially the brand that emanates from the Sun Belt, is how consumerist and materialist it is.
Oh, yeah.
And how obsessed it is with riches and getting something for nothing and getting whacked on the head by God with a sock full of silver dollars.
Well, it's easy to pick on the evangelical brands of religions, the sort of concept that life is like Super Mario Brothers, and if you can save enough souls, you get extra life.
I'm only half picking on it. On the one hand, there are elements of it that are certainly ludicrous. On the other hand, there are elements of it that are tragic and elements of it that are pathetic. And, you know, what it says about the condition of American life now and the emptiness of it and the desperation of it is very troubling.
But here's the problem. These mega churches, this type of religion that's becoming more prevalent in America today, a lot of it's all focused on the afterlife too, you know, and not on fixing the problems we have here today. I understand that there's soup kitchens and they're feeding the poor, but it seems like the one religion or worldview suited to solve these problems is humanism. That would seem to be the one philosophy suited to handle these problems, but these people who are congregating under the banner of humanism are obsessed with all the wrong things. I've talked to them about suburban sprawl. They're oblivious to this. You know, they're just chasing around Richard Dawkins like William Shatner at a Star Trek conference.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to actually play out that way. And one of the reasons that I keep on returning to the idea of religion as an organizing principle in everyday life is that I think we'll be surprised that the kind of churches that people find themselves gravitating to in a, let's say, a long emergency situation is not going to necessarily, in my view, be an evangelical church or a crazy church.
Yeah.
In fact, in my novel, World Made by Hand, the characters are living in a very reduced economy and in very straitened circumstances, living very locally. And yet, their lives really revolve around the congregational church. And these are the normal people in town, the people who are not necessarily even religious. You know, the church has become simply the organization that their social life is centered on. Largely for things like making music and for social events. And
well, I've noticed in Troy, where I live, there's a lot of churches that have been abandoned as the diocese contracts, and they're opening up as the independent sanctuary for media now is being held in a church. You can go see movies while sitting in the pews. So I think that's a good thing.
Well, that's a combination of both the social phenomenon and the adaptive reuse of very valuable buildings, of a type that are not being built anymore, since most new churches are basically built like muffler shops.
I know. But those old churches, it is challenging. I know a friend of mine worked in Holland, and they sort of, after World War II, they sort of turned away from organized religion, and they tried to save the first couple hundred beautiful churches. But after a while, there were just so many empty churches, they had to start knocking them down. They're beautiful buildings, but they're only suited for one purpose, really.
Well, they're best suited for one purpose,
yeah.
Sure. And congregating is the chief purpose of it. And, it remains to be seen how people are going to congregate in the years ahead.
Well, I hope we save some of these buildings so that we can congregate in them, whatever purpose we're congregating
for. Yeah, well, I think we will. And I also think that we'll probably see some of them, built anew in a better way. There's no law that says that you can't return to, to building better buildings of a certain kind in the future. You don't see a whole lot of interest in that now because so many college-educated people are not religious and not involved in that kind of activity. But, it may become more normal again. And not to go there and worship. In fact, in my novel, World Made by Hand, the minister of the Congregational Church says explicitly that he's troubled by the term worship. He doesn't like that term, that you're sort of slavishly paying obeisance to some kind of anthropomorphized God.
Yeah.
But there's certainly a huge realm of the human spirit that is sacred and that needs to be regarded as having a sacred element to it. And we need to honor that in some way so that we can feel that we deserve to continue as a species.
I agree with you, Jim. I'm not a religious person. You're not a religious guy either.
No.
But I wasn't wounded by religion or anything. I just didn't find too much value in a lot of the preaching going
on. Well, I was raised for all practical purposes in a religion-free household. But one of the features of contemporary life is that, when everything is profane, nothing is sacred. And I'm not for all of one or the other, but I do think that we need to bring a little bit more of the sacred back, and not the faux sacred or the fake sacred or the false sacred, but the truly sacred.
Yeah.
And what's truly sacred is not just for, dumb, hysterical people, in a religious transport or a apocalyptic rapture. The sacred is also for people who are thoughtful and people who are educated. There's no reason why they shouldn't have some recognition of it and pay some attention to it.
Well, I suppose I should point out that I have talked with him at E.O. Wilson, the great biologist, who is currently working on an effort to get the evangelical churches to recognize global warming, instead of just saying, oh, we're just going to be raptured up to heaven, so,
Is he an evangelical? I wasn't aware of that.
No, he was raised in the South, though, in the Baptist culture, so he kind of speaks the lingo.
Okay.
And he's been very successful in getting the evangelicals to acknowledge global warming and try to take some steps. So maybe that's something that positive we can look forward to in the future of, religion sort of changing its message to address the more secular concerns of humanity.
Well, I guess what I was trying to say before was we may be surprised by the outcome, as we move through what E.O. Wilson calls a kind of bottleneck of civilization where it's a difficult passage, and we move through this, and we see that the spiritual dimension of life takes new forms, not necessarily the dumb and degraded forms that we've been familiar with in the television age, but maybe something newer and more worthy of respect.
It's been great talking with you, Jim.
A pleasure to be here as always.
You've been listening to the Kunstler Cast featuring James Howard Kunstler. To leave a listener comment, call toll-free at 866-924-9499. Send email to letters@kunstlercast.com. You can download episodes of this program, read transcripts, learn about our theme music, and join our mailing list at kunstlercast.com. I'm your host, Duncan Crary. Thanks for listening.
If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.